The question really I want to start out with before getting to actual texts is, what is Agada? What does the word mean? What's its status? How are we meant to learn it? What does it do? What are we doing here, basically? In order to do that, I want to sort of give a quick run through of what major authorities thought about Agada, starting with the sources from Chazal themselves, through into the Middle Ages. It's past the Middle Ages, gets very complicated. I can't really do that. But so the first question is, what is Agada? And the first thing you want to see is, how does the word Agada appear in Chazal itself? And most of the time, when we see the term Agada, it occurs in the course of a list, the sort that we're going to see in the first two sources. I'd like to start actually with the second source. Mishnah Masechet Nedarim, Perek Dalin. So it starts, Hamudar haname chavero, shokel et shiklo, upore et chovo, machzilo et avedato, makom shnatu alas schar taful hana lehektesh. So, this is talking about a case in which a person is mudar hana'a. A person takes a neder that they will not get any benefit from another person. Why a person would do this is still a little unclear. My sense is there are a lot fewer actual cases of it than there are in the Gemara, because there's an unbelievable number of cases like this in the Gemara. But nedarim is sort of a useful mechanism in halacha, because because of the fact that you can construct anything out of nedarim, you can customize any neder to what you want. It's a very good test case for all sorts of halachic constructs, and also it prods the meaning of every word. Every word has to be defined, as it were. That's in fact where that in fact is the source of the joke No Soap Radio. Because there's a whole discussion where, how do you know if something is part of a word? He says, is one type of vegetable included in a category of another type of vegetable? He says, well, if someone goes to the market and says they don't have this, but they have that, then it's considered part of the same general group. And so therefore, if you take a neder not to use soap, you're not allowed to listen to the radio. That seems very clear. So here, it's going to help us with another linguistic problem. So it says that basically, if you take this, you can do all of these things. It's not considered hana'a, because basically there's no actual monetary gain. You can pay off someone's machzit ha-shekel, you can pay off their tax debt, basically, and pour their chov, their general, even paying their debts. The money doesn't go right into their pocket. You can return their aveda, but in cases where people used to get rewards, people would pay, so then that money would have to go to Hekdesh. Right, we'll go to the Beit HaMikdash, because if you didn't pay at all, then you'd be getting benefit by not having to pay. So therefore, we have to go to Hekadesh. Okay, and Vitorim et Trumato, Mishnah Gimel, Umasrotav, Lidato. You can take Truma for someone. It's not value added. Umakriva alav kinei zavim, kinei zavot, kinei yoladot, chatot vashamot. All these types of karbanot that person might be chayavin, you can give on their behalf. And then, only I have in dark print, you should have in dark print. Umilamdo midrash halachot v'agadot, aval lo yilamdenu mikra. So it says that you can teach him, you can learn from him, midrash halachot and agadot, but not mikra. So it seems that, what do we have here? What do we know about these categories now? We have four terms.
Translated to money.
What?
What do you mean?
So, we have three categories. We have four categories, which are broken up into a set of three and one, right? Mm-hmm. So what do we know about the one?
Mitzvah to learn.
It's a mitzvah to learn all of it, but
the mitzvah to pay money.
It's permitted to pay money for mikra. Yeah, but so
to learn mikra,
to teach mikra, right? You can permit it to charge for teaching mikra. I don't exactly understand why. It has to do with the fact that you're teaching, I think, technical things that aren't really Torah. which apparently means that you're supposed to teach diktuk when you teach chumash, which is very strange because no one seems to believe that. But that's mikra. So if mikra is one thing, what do all the other categories fit into? This is all Torah, it seems. It's all a question of teaching Torah. So one category is mikra, and then what's the other category going to be? Torah Shebal Peh, right? So we now know that we have three categories of Torah Shebal Peh, right? Midrash, Halachot, and Agadot. What are they? What can we see from here?
Three separate things.
They're three separate things.
Agadot, Midrash, and Agadot.
Except that, can we really distinguish between them? In other words, we have Halachot and Agadot. So we have this notion that Halacha and Agadah are different. But what's the difference between Midrash and Agadah? Midrash and Halacha.
Midrash explains the Chumash. Midrash is the connect between the text and the...
Okay, but we have, as we'll see in a second, we have their Halachot, which are Midrashim, which are Agadic. They're Midrashim, which are Halachic. Right? There's Midrash Agadah, Midrash Halacha. So how do these categories fit together? Are they mutually exclusive categories? Are they? Is there a clear division?
It looks like it, right? I mean, in other words, they all come under one umbrella, but
they're separate. But the question is, how separate are they?
If we assume that this Mishnah is, you know, linguistically perfect in that sense, you know.
But even if we have these sorts of categories, so you have, we talk about, you know, so basically this is a curriculum. These are things that people study. So we have reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? In the old. So now those are three different things. But when it comes down to it, well, you know, there's lots of exercises that reading and writing are really intertwined. And when there's all sorts of word problems which are really teaching reading comprehension at the same time they're teaching. So, yeah, they're three different things, and we can distinguish between them. You would certainly wouldn't say that you know, you only need, you know, two of the 3 hours and you can cover it all. But they aren't necessarily such radically set out things that at any given point you can say, oh, now we're doing this, now we're doing that, right? The same thing with, you know, you say history, literature, and philosophy. So they're all different, they're different departments, but there's overlap. It doesn't have to be the exact, it's not clear, but it isn't obvious to us exactly what these categories mean.
Well, there'll be two categories. Midrash, halacha, midrash, agadah, when you have...
it could be right. Midrash, halachot, v'agadot. The problem is that usually you see, this is a sort of truncated, you could still mean that, but usually the list is going to be mikra, midrash, halacha, v'agadot. In other words, mikra gets taken off the front because it's separated out. But even there you could say midrash, colon, halachot, v'agadot, but then that's a little strange, because then the problem then is that it's not a full catalog of Torah Shebal Peh. There's all this stuff that isn't Midrash, isn't there. It's not just Midrash Halacha, Midrash Agadah. What about...
I don't know what kind of Torah Shebal Peh there is. Maybe.
We know, in other words, as far back as we go, we know that not all... look, this is a whole historical question, but fundamentally, we're in the Mishnah. We know Mishnah is not Midrash, right? So, l'chora, there's an awareness that there's something else other than that. It's possible not. It's also, this is an older thing where people only learn... Everything was done through Midrash. There are a lot of people who believe that. That, you know, Midrash is the root of everything. But once again, it's not, so we have this general notion that it is a category of study, the general notion that the fact that it's next to halacha probably isn't coincidental, at least based on our, you know, our preconceived notions, that it's somehow related or opposed to halacha. But the exact relation, the exact nature of these categories is problematic. And that's just true across the board. I don't know. I'm not aware of anyone who's actually gone ahead and defined all these terms that pop up. And these are just examples. There, as we'll see in the next one, there are a whole bunch of these terms, these curriculum terms that define different types of Torah. And each one sounds okay, but when you start thinking, well, what's the difference between this one and that one? How does it work? We don't have such a clear picture of what these terms exactly meant. Particularly, as we'll see, when none of these books that we're familiar with have been written yet. So when it talks about, as we'll see, when it talks about Talmud, hundreds of years before what we call the Talmud was written, so what's it referring to? It's not a hard and fast thing. It's an area of study. It's not a book. Okay, let's take a look at the next source. Just want to read a little more, so I'm going to read it from the book. It's from the Sifrei. The Sifrei Devarim. Anyone know what the Sifrei is?
Two of them.
What?
There are two.
There are two of them, which are? Sifrei Dvarim and Sifrei Bamidbar, right? And they are?
Midrash Halacha.
They are what we call Midrash Halacha. And in the sense that they focus, that they're organized around Midrash, Halachic Midrashim, which is why we only have four of them. The four basic ones are the Mechilta on Shemot, the Sifra on Vayikra, and the Sifrei Bamidbar and Sifrei Devarim. We only have four of them because Bereishit doesn't make it in because there is halacha there. There's not enough halacha to make to justify a book. And there are other ones also which have been published in the last 100-odd years, which have been come out of the Geniza and the like. But those are the ones that we're generally familiar with. So we call them Midrashei Halacha, but the proper name or the most accurate name is Midrashei Tanaim. What really distinguishes them is these are the Midrashim that were written by the Tanaim and were more or less finished by the time of the Mishnah. And are written in, and like the Mishnah, therefore, are written in straight Hebrew. There's no Aramaic in it. This is before Hebrew sort of loses its stature. And this is on the Midrash on Ha'azinu. This is a very nice whole flow of Midrashim on the poetry of Ha'azinu. And it says, Davar Acher, Yarov Kimatar Lichi, is where it starts here. But it says that a zillion times, I just remember the right one. Mama Tarze, okay. Mama Tarze Yored Al Ha'ilanot. Vinotain Bahem Mat Amim, Lakol Achad Vachad, Lithimashahu, Bagethin, Lithimashu Bagethin, Lithimashu Bazayan, Lithimashu Bateina. Oh, sorry, no. Bagethin Lithimashu, Bazayan Lithimashu, Bateina Lithimashu, Tach Divrei Torah, Kulaka Achad, Vyeshba Mikrau Mishna Talmud Halachot Vagadot. So first let's just explain this, and I want to go on, and we've seen the whole piece, we'll come back to it. So what's this basically saying? What's the mashal? What's the arof kimatar likhi? Which doesn't mean literally. What?
It comes down, but I
don't know. I said like orif, I guess like the rain gets to the back of your neck. Is that what it means? The rain on the back of your neck like that?
No, it means when you
slaughter
someone, you...
Oh,
what?
Yeah, we fought the Welsh, I think.
Right. Right. So let my lekach, right, let my teaching come down like rain. So what Chazal are doing here, and this is something that's more common, which defines the way Chazal read Shir HaShirim, but it's often what happens in poetry, is the Tanakh sets out a metaphor. It's a simile, a metaphor, a comparison. In the pshat, there's generally, you can establish what do these two things have in common? What's the simple pshat? Yarov kimatar lichi tizol katal imrati.
My lekach is like the rain, and then he explains it.
And how is it like the rain? Forget about this.
In the
simple reading of the psukim, though.
It's perceived differently according to the...
No. Forget about the medrash. In the pshat and the psukim. Yarov kimatar lichi tizol katal imrefi. Kitzur mele deshev uchiruvim male yezev. What does Moshe mean?
There's four different ways the water comes down. So there's when the rain comes down quickly, one comes down for a long time, short time.
Yeah.
And we come down as do...
Right.
So each one of these has a different nature.
And but what's he saying? What's the simple?
To nurture the plants.
Right. It's life giving, and there's the all encompassing. I think it's these different terms all come together to mean precipitation. And just as the rain comes down and gives life, so too my words should come down and give life. Right. That's the simple interpretation. What Chazal do in order to break more meaning out of the pasuk is to say, no, that's not what they have in common. What they have in common is not just this fact of life-giving, but rather something else. In this case, they're not negating the pshat. They're just sort of going deeper. We're going to find something else which they have in common. When Chazal always talk that Shir HaShirim is allegorical, Chazal thinks it's allegorical, it's completely wrong. It's just a misuse. It's not. It's a legitimate mistake because, you know, art scroll, you know, so you have to, the legitimate mistakes have to be pointed out, but they're legitimate, you know. Because that's the way the Rishonim thought. The Ibn Ezra certainly thought that way. Rashi probably thought that way. But Chazal didn't. In Shir HaShirim, what's all that's happening is they're saying, this is a story about Klal Yisrael and God. And that's their ground assumption of the text, because the actual characters are never named. They just speak. They're just these disembodied voices. So they make a move. They say, really, we have to understand that these are the speakers. Once you understand that, the meaning of all of the metaphors, which is what distinguishes Shir HaShirim as biblical poetry, is its richness of metaphor, much more so than anything than any other poetry, now take on new meaning. And that's what the Midrash is doing. Now, all of a sudden, what does it mean? If it's referring to God, right? Or if it's referring to Klal Yisrael. So now you need a whole new set of understandings, a whole new set of context. So to hear what you're opening up, by the way, Kolei Charev Marech Na'aveh is the only pasuk in Shir HaShirim that Chazal fans actually interpret literally. Right? Anyone know what it is? Kolei Sha'ed. I'm sorry. Kolei Charev Marech Na'aveh and Sarayich Ke'eder right, is Kisri Rosh. So the only things, the only times that Chazal ever actually see an actual woman in Shir HaShirim.
But the quality take the metaphor you take from a real set of rules, so you take the set of rules too.
I understand, but the fact is, but it's interesting. Those are the only times that we. But that's the whole thing. But we get to the ground when we're learning halacha, and then all of a sudden we're interested in the physical things, the physical bodies, which are suddenly more interesting to us. And we also, like I said, these are the only cases where Chazal actually do it. Okay, so here, instead, what's the new metaphor? The metaphor is, what does rain do? And this challenges us, I mean, it might even offend the biologists, the botanists here. Mm-hmm. But what does the rain do? What's mysterious about the rain?
It says here that it gives each tree its own flavor.
Right, everything has its own flavor. How does it work? The same... Right, the same rain comes down,
feeds each one,
and it different. And every rain comes down. You see, the same rain would produce everything. Would have to just be roses. It would all have to come up roses. But somehow, the roses come up roses, and the daffodils come up daffodils. You know,
not because of the rain.
I said I didn't. You know, you always have to. You know, in teaching these things, you always have to know the people, audiences, that their sensibilities and the like. You have to be careful about. You know. And the botanists are one of them, you know. Yeah, you know. But, so that's the drasha. And so too, what's the nimshal, Kilo?
Torah.
That what?
Torah has many different
flavors. Right?
Or affects different people.
We'll get to this next line. But here it's different. The Torah is different flavors, just like you have there's olives and dates and figs and all sorts of stuff. So too, Torah comes in different flavors, as it were. We'll get back to it just in terms of our purposes. Let's just see the whole flow. Kis irim alei desha, mas irim halalo yordim al asavim umalim otam. V'yesh mehem adomim, v'yesh mehem yirokim, v'yesh mehem shchorim, v'yesh mehem levanim. Kach divrei Torah, yesh behem b'nei adam chachamim, b'nei adam ksherim, b'nei adam tzadikim, b'nei adam chasidim. Similar notion of this, I mean, it's the notion, the feeling that you have is sort of almost of, you know, the clear water, it's almost like white light that gets split into a spectrum. So it comes into these, it turns into, that it turns all these different colors. How does the water... How does the clear water create all these different colors of grasses? I don't know enough about these different types of rain. Is the matar dafka for the trees, and the what's it called, and the si'irim dafka for the desha, or is that, I don't know.
Do you have si'irim elsewhere in the Torah? I think we have that here.
Concordatio.
What's concordatio? Tell you figure it out. It's not, okay, whatever. So that's the next thing. Once again, this notion of different aspects of Torah, pluralistic Torah, right? The notion that there's no one Gedolim story, but there's different types of people who have different aspects, and that they're all, it's Torah comes out of all of them, and it's not this flattened sort of, you know, emulsified version where everything's all put together. And then the last one, if you don't have a davar acher, mama tar ze, I ataro elo ad sheba, v'chein hu omer vayhi ad kovi ad kov, ashamayim nitkadru ba'avim. Right, what's that from? What story?
It's Eliyahu.
Eliyahu, right. When what?
With Har Carmel.
Right, and finally this, the what's it called comes, and the clouds come. Kach, talmid chacham, eina tayodea mahu, ad shigishane midrash halachot v'agadot, o ad shiyitmane parnas al hatzibur. I'm not exactly sure what they're trying to tell you. It sounds like just the fact that someone has a reputation as a great Talmid Chacham, until you've seen him in action, you can't quite be sure. I'm not sure if it's so cynical.
It's simple. I think it's honest.
Honest. Okay. So, okay. That's that's.
Depends how cynical.
That's cynical. That's always they say that depressed people are more realistic than healthy people. So, it's the same sort of cynical, honest. I mean, but so that's the larger picture. Now, in terms of our purpose, so this notion that Torah is multiform, that it comes in lots of different flavors. The question is, can you buy it in a single flavor? Because in Israel, it's impossible to buy ice cream just one flavor. It's always mixed flavors. I can't stand that. Unless you buy the Ben & Jerry's. So here the question is, it seems that they all come like one thing. It's hard to tell. But you have this Mikra u'Mishnah, Talmud, Halachot, v'Hagadot. Right? Now, here you have, now, just in terms of Hagadot versus Agadot, an unbelievable amount of ink has been spilled on this, along with Agadita. As far as my impression from having my quick review of the literature is that there's nothing to it, and that the simple answer that everyone gives is the right answer, that Haggadah is Hebrew / Eretz Yisrael spelling, Agadah is Bavel / Aramaic spelling, Agadita is simply the full Aramaic term in Babylonian Aramaic.
What are our kids doing using the Babylonian spelling?
What?
Their kids do ah instead of ha.
Right, yeah.
So it seems these are just, right, well that's why, because you spell it now, like, right. Because now everything should be an aleph, right.
Yeah.
It really shouldn't.
That's
shouldn't
what
be.
They do.
Right. So that's the spelling. You have, by the way, Rabbi Akiva is spelt both ways at the end. Aleph or Hay at the end. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the difference is halachic, is traditional rabbinic works versus Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. And the Kabbalah in the Zohar. Is that right? Oh, you nodded knowingly. I want to confirm that. That's my understanding. That's why. That's the difference. That's his. He has different aliases. As far as I can tell, there's no difference between the words. But there is a claim that there's a very fundamental difference. You're Rebbe. From what's it called? From Hebrew, from Hebrew law school. So what are these things? Now I think once you get the longer list, it becomes even more difficult to figure out what these things are. So Mikra sounds pretty good. We know what that is, right? Mishnah, Talmud, Halachot, v'Agadot. So, what's Mishnah? Does it refer to the Mishnah? It's possible, we don't really know exactly, could this have been edited 20 years after the Mishnah was edited? It's possible, but even then, were people referring to the Mishnah as being so radically different from the other sets of Braitot that were floating around? Or did that take time? The impression is that it took some time for it to gain, that's the dominance that it has, that you talked about, the Mishnah. So maybe Mishnah refers to... Definitely doesn't refer to the Mishnah Torah. Doesn't. Those of us who have had brisker educations like to think that the Mishnah Torah preceded the Mishnah, but it didn't. So, Sefer Dvarim, that's under Mikra. That's I think so. Unless you're, that causes other problems. Right? Mishnah, then, so what's Talmud? Talmud clearly isn't Vilna Shas, not Daf Yomi, right? And then what's the difference between Talmud and Halachot? And Halachot, there's Halachot and Mishnah is particularly problematic because often they're separate. You tend to think that, so Mishnah means the simple listing of Halachot, and Talmud refers to the dialectic, the discussion, all the reasoning. But what's the difference between Halachot and Mishnah? like I said. And then you get Haggadot or Agadot. It's all very difficult to put together. And we see at the end, in the second one, you also have Midrash Halachot Vagadot. And by the way, here you have Midrash Halachot Vagadot again, mm-hmm. without the Mikra. But presumably that's because a Talmud Chacham wouldn't be getting up and teaching Tanakh. Right? That was sort of assumed. Right? He might give Drashot. But simply knowing Tanakh, learning Tanakh, right? When the Rambam says you learn Tanakh and then you're done with it, mm-hmm. and then you move on, he means you learn it by heart, and then you can do midrash, all sorts of midrashim and all, and philosophy and all sorts of things with it. But learning Tanakh simply meant knowing all the words. So it wasn't that wasn't considered so impressive. So here we once again have a sense of it being part of the curriculum, a sense that sort of one flavor, one distinct flavor. It's constantly juxtaposed against halakha. But it's not clear that they're mutually exclusive. It's not clear that they're opposed in any way. And it's pretty clear that they don't represent the totality of Torah, right? There's halachot and agadot, but there's also mishnah, midrash, and all sorts of other stuff, halachot, all sorts of other stuff floating around. These aren't overarching categories, halacha versus agadah. So that's what you get. That's what comes out. That's what comes out of the first these sort of basic set of things that you have starting the Tanaim and throughout the Gemara. Also, though, it would be interesting to see if those lists are fundamentally no, they're not, because I know there's one about Garama. So
I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, but what about the chronology or the timing of whatever we call Gada?
What do you mean in terms of what?
When did it come? When was it written?
Well, like I said, this is the earliest stuff we've got, and it's already full form.
Okay, and these were written by Tanaim, right? But they mentioned Talmud, so we don't even know what Talmud is.
But Talmud
is, right?
Clearly doesn't, right. So that's the thing. Talmud seems to be an exercise. There's a way of study,
mm-hmm.
something we might call Lamdanut or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know, but it's all very speculative. We just don't, like I said, I don't think anyone's ever gone through and really picked apart all these terms and said, this is what it must mean, mm-hmm. or anything like that. I think, you know, everyone knows more or less what it means, and then people get on with their lives.
But we could say by the time the Tanaim, this stuff existed.
Yeah. Before that, anything before that is just pure speculation. I mean, most of that is just... it's amazing how many people make a living off stuff before the Tanaim. And it's just not, like, you know, look, some of these things you have from other sources, but these are Chazal terms. Anything about Chazal before that, it's just very, it's very speculative. It's very hard to, know. It's like, you know, it's like the Bar Kokhba revolt. Like, you can learn everything there is to know about the Bar Kokhba revolt in about 20 minutes. But somehow, there are volumes and volumes and volumes. You look into atlases, there will be maps of campaigns. Historians don't even know, don't know the name of any battle other than Betar. They don't know what happened. They don't know if there were battles or if it was just no anything. We don't know if it was. We don't know, other than in this area where they found these caves, they're pretty sure they know, and where they found the letters and stuff. No one really knows. Was there a Bar Kokhba revolt in the Galil or not? No one knows. I'm saying it's just so, but somehow, like, it's another one of these things, the same period. That's already the period of Tanaim, but somehow people managed to get milk this stuff for a lot. Okay. There's one last thing, though. Where does Haggadot or Agadot always appear? At the end.
Hmm.
What does that mean?
Maybe less important or
it's
sort of secondary. Sort of like it's not...
Chronologically.
Maybe later.
It's possible,
maybe later.
But what do we start with?
The farthest from the Mikah, from the Psa to the least...
Well, I don't know about the least... But it's a question... who learns, right? I mean, look, we have the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, right? Who learns Chumash? Who learns Mishnah?
10-year-olds.
Who learns Talmud?
15-year-olds.
Well, the question is this postdoctoral work, basically? Is this the most advanced? Well, is it at the end because it's the most advanced? And
no,
there's clearly...
Dr. Gan learns it.
What? That's the question. The question is, if it does refer to some sort of highly advanced scholarship, then clearly it's not what we think of Agadah in terms of what kids are learning in Gan.
Well, it looks like it's also different types of books or bodies of literature, because you have Mikra, Mishnah, and Talmud are describing a type of book, whereas
halachot... We're saying they can't be describing a book.
Well, wait, hold on a second. The halachot and hagadot are, it's in plural, right? It's like a
right.
list of things. So it seems like they would go together in the same category.
Right.
Halachas and agadas,
right?
If it kind of, maybe it's easier to think of it in
they're
English.
Plural.
Right. And Mikra, Mishnah, and Talmud are, whatever it is, it's a corpus of books, it's a group of something that has a definitive name as opposed to a list of things. So not, it could not necessarily be a chronological
order. Yeah, but the problem, as we said, that these terms, we think of these terms, Mishnah and Talmud, as referring to discrete books. But they
right.
almost certainly, Talmud certainly didn't refer to a discrete book at the time this was written.
Right,
and Mishnah probably doesn't either.
So maybe it's a way of learning.
Versus a collection of
why does it say
stuff?
Breitelt or, I don't know, Breitelt or Mishnayot even? It says, you know.
I understand. Right,
why
yeah, it's a question, right.
Categorized differently, so
right.
maybe it's enough different way
all
of
these things,
of
right. Right. The problem is that there's no bedrock here. In other words, these are all mm-hmm. sort of, and that's part of the problem, is we don't quite know. What we do know, you know, we're just...
Speculations.
What?
You can write a book about it.
Exactly.
Right.
People do that. So I gave an article I wrote to Adina Moshavi, and she read it, and she said, you didn't prove your point, but so what? She said, you proved it as well. You made as good a case as most of the articles I read, so I think you're ready to go. Adina would never publish anything like that I can assure you. But, okay. So, like I said, we have this notion, the possibility is out there that Agada is some sort of advanced study, in which case it doesn't fit with our preconceptions of what it is. But that might not be. There are these linguistic issues of halachot v'agadot. There are also all these rules which mess things up about the way in which Chazal order words. We sometimes see that Mishnayot will have orders out of chronological order, and there are these rules which people have figured out, which are actually pretty neat because they actually work. Like chupa v'kiddushin, right? Why is it chupa v'kiddushin? It's kiddushin v'chupa, right? But you always have the longest word last. Mm.
Right.
And so Shama Friedman has this whole article about it. It's amazing that
he spent so much time thinking about this.
Right.
It would
the halachot v'agadot
fits. It just flows.
Right. So I'm saying you have these sorts of factors which make it very difficult to know what's really going on. But that's what we have. That's sort of the mainstream of the sources on Agadah that you're going to get. There are quite a few interesting sources that we're not going to do, but... That's what you get. Now, once you move to the Gemara, though, once you get to the Gemara...
Oh, by the way, that could be the answer to your question.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the longest words. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Right, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying
I'm saying
there's so many factors floating around. We have so little ground to base it on. But this is what we have. This is what we know. But what we do know is, one thing we do know is, like I said, that it's a form of Torah. It doesn't seem to be... radically distinct from the other form. They seem to all fit together, and we can't tell where the lines are, and it might well be that's because the lines really aren't clear, that these are overlapping territories, as it were, and that it's not, and there doesn't seem to be a radical valuing of one over the other, or any competition. They all seem complementary. The thing we posit is possibly the fact that Agadot comes last might reflect some importance to it, or maybe it's the fact that it's an afterthought, as it were.
Don't halachot and haggadot come together?
Yeah.
Midrash halacha, midrash haggadah, so it flows.
It flows, I'm saying, so you have all these things, the question of what, you know, usages, and it's hard to know what's driving these things. Okay. Now, once you get into the Gemara, then you start seeing a conflict. There are at least the two stories that we're going to see now, about between what's called Shmatita and Agadita. Shmatita, or Shmaitza, as it was generally pronounced, at least in Eastern Europe, is fundamentally a synonym for halacha. And here all of a sudden you have this notion that there are only two options out there. It's either Shmatita or Agadita. And all of a sudden, we have a different vision of what Agada is, halacha is, and how it, there are these sort of two all-encompassing sort of categories. So, source three is the first one. Someone want to read? I'm sort of losing, running out of water.
more you learn.
But loud. And slow.
Sorry, I was going to break it down, but I would have doubled the number of pages if I put it into clear lines. Okay. What happens? No. Back up. Whoa. So what happened? Yeah, let's start. Yati Rami Yami Ravasi Kamei Rav Yitzchak Nafcha. What does that mean?
Lema Mar Shmata.
They're sitting there's Yativ Kamei is a standard term where you have students sitting before a Rebbe. So Mar Amarle Lema Ma. Right, so what happens?
One of them said Shmata.
Now already, by the way, there's something sort of interesting about what do you expect usually, right, when you have this sort of setup, Yativ X Kamei to Y, or Yativ X to Y Kamei to Y, then there's going to be a statement. What do you who do you expect to make that statement, or what's the nature of the statement going to be?
The Rebbe's going to teach.
Or a question. Here, all of a sudden, it's not what's happening at all. They're already in control, which is what we'll see in the close. It's very interesting. And the only thing that comes to mind, which isn't stated in the story, and which seems like it should be if it was true, is when do the Talmidim have the right to choose what's being learned?
Okay.
That's from Rabbi Frankel.
Never.
What?
After this year.
No, before what's called before Yantif, Nerv Yantif. Mm. And you'll still, Rebbe will still do that. The last day of whatever is Nerv Yantif. Okay, what do you want to do based on that? So you have the sense that the students feel this control, but it doesn't say that. The students are just somehow in control here. Mm. Okay. So what happened? Patach
l'meimar.
So what happened?
They couldn't read.
Bifa started telling them.
This is why the Rebbe talk.
Well, me translate the Gemara. Okay, you see, you clearly understand it, but yeah.
One wanted to say Agatha, and I don't know who didn't let him.
It doesn't say which one's which, that it's not recorded, but one of them.
Mar and Mar.
Right. So one of them says. He can't do it. Says so. He started to do halacha. One of them shouted him down. Basically, he started to do agadah. The other one shouted him down. Okay. So already, what do we have here? What's the relation to halacha and agadah?
It's a dichotomy. They're contrasts.
But they're equal. But they're also in conflict. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of fundamental sense that you know you can talk all you like about you know a harmony of all these things. There are only so many hours in the day, so many years in a life, and you got to make choices. And you got to decide. And therefore, there's almost inevitably this conflict between these two things. Okay. So what does he say? Okay, first of all, what language is this in?
Hebrew.
Just happens. It's really weird. But the stories just go into Hebrew and back into Aramaic. Yeah. I once asked Moshe Bar Asher about that, the great linguist, and he said, when you find an answer to that, I want you to tell me first.
You walk here in a fair view and you see how people talk.
Yeah, I know. It seems
perfectly natural.
Yeah,
but
people
are
in
Elavai, you speak in Hebrew.
What?
In Elavai, you speak in Hebrew. When you get up to speak, you speak in Hebrew.
Like I said, it's possible. I'm saying in individual stories, that's just saying I had a bunch of theories. Individual stories, sometimes it seems like there's like a logic to it. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, is there a real logic to it? He said, no. He says, you're not. He says, no one's ever found. He says, any theory you'll find in any given place, you're never going to get one that. There's no general rules. Here it makes sense that the teachings were recorded as teachings in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. That's the way it was. But who knows? So what does he say? This is in Hebrew. What does he say?
What's the story? Someone had two eyes. One young, one old, And the old one didn't pull out his black hair, the young one pulled out his white hairs.
So what's going on here? What's going on in the story? What's the mashal, what's the nimshal?
Each one values something else.
Each, yeah.
Just like these two guys. Value both, you're left with nothing.
Right. That's yes. The, that, no, exactly. We can't, you can't, if you keep, if you're each going to block the other one, then you're, we're going to be left with nothing. Then it's just worthless. It's better to have, clearly it's better to have gray hair than no hair. And not everyone believes that, actually. But but that seems to be the assumption here. What's going on? First of all, what's the mashal and nimshal, right? The standard mashal is mashal ha-melech, is God. And then he has a son, or sometimes a daughter, who's B'nai Yisrael. Sometimes he has an advisor, who's going to be someone like Moshe. Right? What's the mashal and nimshal here?
Me and you.
What?
Me and you. He and the students.
He and the students are what?
Old and new. Old and young.
Old and young. But no, but if he, the Rebbe is...
Oh, and the
Talmidim are?
The wives.
This is not obvious, right? It's not obvious that we understand the relationship between a Rebbe and his Talmidim in terms of a relationship between husband and his wives. We don't fully relate to this notion of husband and his wives, but nevertheless...
The Torah would be the husband in this case.
Have, oh, no, it's clear, it's the Rebbe. It's the Rebbe that he's saying, you're going to leave, we're not going to get left with nothing. Mm-hmm.
But it's not him that's going to be left with nothing. It's not a Rebbe that's going to have nothing. It's a Torah that's going to be...
There's going to be no teaching. There's only
the Torah is the...
I think he's saying you're going to leave me bald. You're going to say me that I'm not going to teach anything. I'm not going to be able to teach anything. If you say you can't teach this and you can't teach that, so then there's nothing left. Right? But that whole dynamic is very interesting. It's a little strange, and it's very interesting. Now... It's not easy for us because we're not exactly sure what they think this relationship between husband and wife is supposed to be. We don't know what either relationship is exactly supposed to be. But it's a very funny relationship. As we said, clearly the husband is supposed to be in control. Clearly the Rebbe is supposed to be in control. But in both cases, and as is obvious to them, the wife sometimes is in control. The wife is always trying to mold the husband, right, in her own image. That's what each one is trying to do.
Oh, God.
What? In these stories, I said. I didn't say that.
Not real life.
You know. Especially if you have someone else on the other side. You know? So, it's the whole, just the way in which Chazal make use of these mishalim, but the whole playthrough, the story within the story, is very interesting in terms of that, how it follows through. So what happens? Amar Lahen. Right, you want to read on? What does that mean? Right. So what will we do? I'll say something that is Shaveh L'Kol Nefesh, right? I'll say something that will make both of you happy. Right? What does he say? Okay, I'll read through. This is the drush I want to... What's the pasuk? Shalini shalim hamavira tabeira. I'm just reading from the inside. So it's Parashat Mishpatim. We're in the middle of the Nezikin section. All sorts of torts, right? Ki yaver ish sade ocherem. Okay, that's not the one. Next. Ki teitzei esh, umatzah kotzim, v'nochal gadish, o akama o hasadeh. I'm not sure what gadish is, but some sort of grove.
Haystack?
I don't know, some sort of vegetable matter. And it burns someone else's stuff in their fields. There's a fire, the wind comes and blows a fire, right? Shalei nishalim hamavira tabeira. Who has to pay? The person who lit the fire. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the pasuk. It's pretty straightforward in terms of from the simple pshat of the pasuk. Okay? So what does he do? First he says, "Teitzei me'atzma," goes out by himself. By itself, it's very hard to understand what this is doing here. It belongs at the end. Okay. Shalem yishalem amavira tabeira. Amar Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Alai l'shalem et habeira shehivarti. Ani hitzati esh b'tzion. Shneamar. ויצאת אש בציון ותאכל יסודותיה ואני עתיד לבנותה באש נאמר ואני אהיה לה חומת אש סביב ולכבוד אהיה בתוכה. So what does he do with this psukim?
This is the rabbi talking?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's he doing with these psukim now?
Now he's doing an agadita.
Yeah, but what is he doing?
He's not teaching pshat. He's teaching.
It's definitely not what we would call pshat. Mm-hmm. What's he doing? How is he? How is his mind working? Can we reconstruct what's going on in his mind?
Associative.
So what happens? Ki teitzei ish, right? This notion of fire. Immediately goes to various other fires in Tanakh, and you have this notion of divine fire. Right? What does the divine fire do? Well, on the one hand, it destroys the Beit HaMikdash, obviously not literally, because obviously God, the fire doesn't come down from heaven, right? It's the Bavlim who burn the Beit HaMikdash. On the flip side, it's this divine protective fire, right? Which, in this Nevuah in Zechariah, protects Yerushalayim in the new Yerushalayim in the Geula, right? He says, it actually says, so it's very interesting in Nevuah, it says basically that Yerushalayim will, it's very it will become basically the Nevuah of the new city, that Yerushalayim will spill out from its walls and it will become an unwalled city because there will be so many people in it. Urban sprawl seems to be a good thing. So what's going to happen now, it's great there's so many people there, but now what do we have? We have a whole open city, which is open to attack. So what's going to happen, God is going to surround it in fire. God will protect it, there'll be no more need for walls. That's the drasha. And it's picking up on a fundamental midrashic motif, particularly around Eicha, which is God's responsibility for the exile, for the Chorban. Usually, it's not like, what do you mean God did this? What do you mean God's the mazik? God's not the mazik. He's the executioner. This is justice, divine justice. But very often you see that God, in these mishalim and in these midrashim, is sort of responsible for the exile, responsible for the korban, and it seems like it really wasn't such a good idea. And God sort of is now responsible. He now has to pay back, right? Just like, and that's exactly what they're doing, they're taking this notion from torts, this notion that you have to pay back what the damage that you have done. They say, this applies to God too. So they've taken this most human of texts, deals basically with the most day-to-day sort of event, and raised it up by saying, God has to do this also. Shofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. Therefore, God is responsible for, the reason why he has to bring us back from the Geula is because he put us into Galut. And therefore, he's responsible. It's just he has to pay. He has to make amends. And what's nice is, of course, is that then the fire becomes the method of payment also. Mm-hmm. So the fire is not just, the method of payment should be money, but here, the bad fire is countered, is paid back with a good fire. Okay. Okay, then it says, Shmatita, Patacha Katuv, I didn't put on page numbers. Binizke mimono, v'siyeh binizke gufo, lomar lecha, eisho mishum chetzio. What's the halachic? What do we learn? What's the halachic drasha? Five steps ahead. What's the pasuk? What's the drasha in the pasuk? What's the problem? What does that mean?
Tete'esh, even if it's not a...
What's the problem with the pasuk?
Tete'esh, it's not associated to someone who... Initially, it's not associated to a person.
So you have to... Pasuk, and then...
Hamavira
tabeira, right? In other words, the pasuk is a little striking. Ki tete'esh matzakotzim. You have this notion. Well, you know, it happens. There are fires. Like, it doesn't say that there is anyone there. What the Chazal are picking up on is... But then at the end, it says, well, whoever lit the fire is responsible. Mm-hmm. There's something almost sort of, I mean, sort of from a narrative point of view, the story or the narrative that unfolds here is sort of, they're withholding key information. There's the initial sense, it sort of like picks up with your initial sense of halacha, of what we would think. Like, oh, fires, you know, they burn. Like, what can you do? If a fire jumps, I have to be responsible because I have a fire going in my, you know, I mean, that's clearly the notion in Israel where, you know, I mean, there's clearly no liability for a Madurah lit. I don't think. I don't know. But and then at the end it says Hamavir et Habeira. All of a sudden, this person, this agent, appears only at the end of the story. So what does he learn? What do we learn from this? Eishom mishum chetzio, that a fire is like a ches. What's a ches?
Arrow.
But what does it embody in halacha and these sorts of torts?
Full control, or wherever you stand at one point, then you could reach another point.
That it's indirect, that you let go, right? I mean, because the wind can come and blow your arrow. Well, of course. Right? You could have, the fact is, you know, you didn't do it. But the point is, once you release that energy and set the process into motion, then you're responsible for whatever happens, regardless of what happens, basically.
So God created fire?
Well, no, it's not that God created fire. It's that God made use of fire in certain places.
He allowed it to be unleashed, so to
speak. No, and these, well, okay, here's the, well, no. Here's the interesting question. Because now what you see is that the midrash, the halakha, the agadah, and the halakha sort of fit together. Because also, God didn't directly destroy the Beit HaMikdash, right? It was the Bavlim, right?
Yeah.
He sets it in motion, right? The fire is something that's set in motion. It's the whole, and the whole motif in both cases is of responsibility for the consequences, of the long-term, longer-term or indirect consequences of your actions. Whether it's God or whether it's man. So what is he teaching now about the nature of Agadah and Halakha and their relationship?
That they are related, that they do fit together.
How? First, most basic level.
They answer the same questions.
They what? Before that.
Based on the same Torah.
Come from the same place. The same pasuk generates halacha and agadah. But it's not all obvious. There isn't a whole lot of drashot like this, like these, where you get this sort of theology coming out of pasukim. Usually, usually you get more like the second kind. So that's first of all. Second of all, they're really, they're intertwined. They're dealing with the same themes. One's elaborating on the other. And really, this whole fight that they're having is perhaps not as as big or not as bad as it may seem. So, what do we get from the story overall? What between halacha and agadah? What do we know about it now, based on this story?
It's intertwined.
What?
It's intertwined. I mean, the Rebbe seems to.
But first, before that, what do we see?
That they're in contrast to each other.
They're in contrast to each other. First of all, that seems to be all
that
there is.
Rabbi says.
Right? Mm-hmm. Halakha or agadah. There's only two choices, right? It's chocolate and vanilla flavors. It's just chocolate or vanilla. Right? All of a sudden, everything just is divided into these two camps. And that's it. Because you can't just... Before, it seemed like there was a whole Baskin-Robbins there. But now, it's just... it's just a good humor, man. So that's first of all. Second of all, they are in potential conflict, right? If only because there are only so many hours in the day. And that this conflict also seems to insinuate itself into the politics of Rebbe-Talmud relationships. And so it's partially what drives these sorts of, and the relationships between Talmidim, who are in fact the ones who are directly fighting with each other. But then, on the other hand, that on another level, it seems that this might be somewhat illusory because ultimately, Roeh Echad Netativ, they all came from God, they all come from the same Torah, they all emerge out of the same set of psukim, and they even draw, therefore, on the same themes and motifs. And the notion that you're going to do one or the other might in and of itself be problematic. So that's this story. One more story. I don't think we're going to have time to really do the whole thing. We're starting in a few more minutes. We start late. Where is it? Bye. Oh, yeah. Oh, here it is. Right, 4. Sorry. Okay. Let's see what we do. We start. Abba.
I'm sorry. Just one thing that we get from all three of these lists or sources is that halachot and agadot always sort of
right. But here it's one step more because it's not only do they come together.
In the other ones, it's less clear. But
here it's not just that they're together. This says that's all there is. Mm-hmm. There is any given. You have to. There is everything can be. You know, it's like, you know, I called someone up at a university about a job. And I realized I had no chance at the job because his first question was, he started explaining, well, I do this, and I do that, and I've written an article on this, and I've worked on that, and I taught this. And he says, okay, let's just get to the bottom line. What do you do? Are you Bar Ilan or Hebrew U? And he's like, a pox on both their houses. I mean, what does that mean?
I don't want to say that.
But there was that, but the person couldn't, but that's the notion. It's got to be either this or that. There's no possibility that you'd be doing something different or doing both of them at the same time.
Wow.
So that's number three.
So that's number three. Now there's this stark division and the notion that this encompasses all of Torah or all of teaching Torah. Right? Here it's very clear, by the way, the halacha and agadah refer to the nature of a shiur that's being given by a rabbi. And it's not a text. It's not something that someone's studying by themselves or something. It's the question of halacha, of shmatita versus agadita is a question of that kind, is a question of
that Torah what, is divided into
of what, right, but it's not just Torah, but it's referring specifically to what is the nature of the shiur that the Rebbe is giving, and isn't as opposed to other forms or venues. That we'll see again in this story. Abba iklu lahu atra. Yeah, I don't know. Right. Okay, I didn't check this. I'm so unclear with this. Ava iklu lo atra. What? Rabbi Yehovah v'chi bar Abba. I see. Rabbi Yehovah v'chi bar Abba. Okay, you're right. I just got cut off there. You're right. Good reconstruction. Rabbi Yehovah v'chi bar Abba iklu lahu atra. They came to a certain place. Rabbi Yehovah darash ba'agadita. V'chi bar Abba darash b'shmata. So what happened? What happens? Pretty straightforward now. What happened?
One did this, right?
They went to the same town, right? So what you sort of have now is, so now you have the opposite of similar to the previous story, but also the opposite. Because in the previous story, who was the Agadita and who was the Halacha? No, but who were they? No, not Rabbi Yitzchak. Who represented, the Talmidim represented Halacha versus Agadita. One Talmid, the other. And the question was vis-a-vis a single Rebbe. Mm-hmm. Now you have two rabbis coming in, giving different shiurim, one representing halacha, one representing agadah, vis-a-vis a single town, a single audience, right? So it's the same, it's a similar problem, or a similar demonstration, but different. What happened? Shavku akuli alma l'Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. V'azu l'gabed Rabbi Yavahu. What happened? What happened? What's Shavak? Right?
They all left
Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, and they all ran to Rabbi Yavahu, the Agadashir. But just reading the story, and then what did it say? Chalash Daite. Right? Rabbi Chiya bar Abba was depressed. It's hard to imagine that they really have a word for depressed in the way we understand the term, but that's the way it usually see something like that. He was not happy. His da'at was weakened.
Grew faint.
Yeah. Well, no, it's an emotional state. It's clearly an emotional state. So what happens? What happens? They all go to. They all. They, one of them basically gets a sellout crowd, and the other one has is playing to an empty auditorium. Mm-hmm. Why?
People like
that. We don't know yet.
We don't know yet.
I mean, what are the other possibilities? People left for right. People left to hear Rabbi Yehovah. It doesn't say they went to hear the Agadah. It says they went to hear Rabbi Yehovah, and they didn't go to hear Rabbi Chiya bar Abba.
But they left.
Well, I'm not sure what Shavak means here. My sense is it means doesn't mean that they
actively.
They that wasn't that they walked out. It wasn't that they after seeing. Or then it would be very clear if they actually originally went to Rukia and they said, "Oh God!" Like I mean, conferences you do this all the time. You sit in the middle of a talk, like, "Oh my God, this is terrible. I should have gone to the other session." And gone into the other session, right? So I don't think that's what's. I don't think that's what's happening. I think that he's. My sense is Shavak means they left. In other words, they never went there. You'd have to check. You have to check carefully, but that's my sense.
So that usually means leave out.
What?
It means leave out.
Leave out.
Throwing something out.
It means to leave, to abandon. Right. They abandoned, but... Yeah. Okay.
Shavik
etera achlisura. Shavik etera achlisura. So you're not... Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if the difference in Agadata and the Shmata wasn't significant, the Gemara would have mentioned it as a precursor to one going to one, not going to the other.
It's true, but then, but if they would have, they could have, but the fact that they emphasized the names, it could be, but it doesn't say exactly. And it's possible that it has to do with, like I said, who is better. I mean, in reality, clearly that's, right, that's what everyone will tell you. Don't worry about what the course is about. If it's a good professor, take it, right? So,
yeah, but if I was telling you a story, you said there was a course in, you know, in history and the course and
I understand, but you also gave me the names of these two people, these two okay. well-known people. So it's not clear. Amar le. So Rabbi Avahu says to Rabbi Chila Abba, "Emshal lecha mashal, lema davar dome." So once again, the pattern. These are clearly these stories are stamped out, and there's in the same fundamental framework. After the basic conflict, you get a mashal. Shnei bnei adam, echad mocher avanim tovot, v'achad mocher minei sidkit. Al mi kovtzin, lo al shem mocher minei sidkit. Okay, so what's sidkit? What?
Chachka's
notions, I think was the best word way to translate it. Chachka's notions, you know, little stuff.
Trinkets,
whatever it is. So two people are selling. So whose store is full? Right. Is the cheap store? Everyone's going into bizarre straps, right? But no one's no. But how many people go into to the Cartier store on King David Street, right? So what does this mean? What's the mashal? What's the mashal?
He's devaluing the agada.
Mm-hmm. So he's devaluing the agada.
It's the common
thing. What's he saying? What is also first of all? What is it saying?
Not about the person either. It's not about the rabbi. He's saying it's not me or you.
It's the merchandise.
Material, yeah.
But what does this tell us first of all about? So it tells us that the clearly is more prestige associated with the halacha. Mm-hmm. But also, what does it tell you about the customers?
Fewer,
but
higher quality.
Higher quality. You'd rather sell one diamond a day, right? Than you would have them to sell all the million of those, a million needles and buttons and whatever
people
else.
Cooked.
What?
People cooked.
Yeah. And right, clearly the what's it clearly right? Everyone passes by the what's it called the little kiosk by the Tachana Merkazit, right? Pops their head in. But the guy who sells the diamond dealer is not jealous of that guy, right? So what does it say about Agada? About Halacha and Agada?
Pop culture.
It's pop culture, exactly. It's exactly what he's saying. It sounds like he's saying that, it's exactly like saying that, of course the rock concerts sell out, and the pot boilers are at the top of the bestsellers list. But hey, you're dealing with serious music here. You're publishing serious literature here. Of course, it says if too many people bought this stuff, it would be a sign that you're doing something wrong, right? That's the sense. So it's an extremely elitist sort of notion. Notion basically says there's high Torah culture and low Torah culture, and me, I'm just dealing with the masses. But you're doing the important stuff because the implication is also the people who really count are the people who go to. Right, and this you always have, right? You always have these things. I mean, it's a great line from Stephen King when someone asks him, "When are you going to write a serious novel?" And he says, "I've been writing as serious novels as I can my entire life. What do you want from my life?" Right? And there's the notion that you know, but there's this notion that it is just two different things. And you, this guy obviously he could do something serious. It's like, no, this is what he does. He's like, this is what I do. And that's it. But don't think that, and he never claimed to be a great novelist. But don't answer him. I was like, this is what I do. Never, you know. But don't think that just because I'm raking in the millions, and you can barely make a living. But you're doing the really important thing. Now, what do you think of this?
Interesting.
Well, in the abstract, it seems like a reasonable theory. But what's the problem? What makes us have to question it?
How could you say that about Torah?
What? There's no question that Rabbi Avahu knew halacha. I think that you can pretty well demonstrate. But the question is, he's saying, this is what I'm doing, but halacha, it's shmatita. It's a higher level of, we're not talking about. But the problem is Rabbi Avahu is saying this.
Yeah.
Right? If he really believed that,
why would you stick with that God stuff?
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like,
well, why? You just said, you know, like there are the Stephen Kings of the world. There are the people who,
yeah, but Rabbi, the problem is Rabbi Avahu does not seem to be among them. in other words, that you get the sense of what he does. Doesn't seem
to
be
social
saying,
duty to inform the masses. We should leave him uneducated.
Right, but he's saying this is my job. It sounds like it's sort of my job.
My impression is that just that he's trying to make the other Raph feel good.
In other words, it might not be true at all.
Yeah.
Right?
He's saying, you're doing the important stuff.
You're doing the important stuff. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, what's it called? As someone said, you know, this rabbi told me that the most important thing I could possibly do in the world is stay home with your kids. And it was like, clearly he didn't believe that. Otherwise, he would have left the base metrics right now and gone home to his kids. So clearly, there's a problem here, right? what's going on? So you have this question. There's something sort of wondering whether or not this is quite what's going on. And that's followed through by the fact that it doesn't work. It says, "Kol yom ha'amim malavu b'chiyah bar avah l'rabbi Avahun, l'rabbi Avahu ad ushpizeh." What's ushpizeh?
Hotel.
It means his residence. I mean, his domicile. What?
It's not where they live.
I know, but here it seems like it has to be, because it's every night. What, he was a traveling salesman?
Well, they went. Story starts.
They could go each way. Could they were on a tour or something? Yeah. Okay. Mishum yikra de bekesar. That's where the story starts to get a little suspicious, right? Why does he walk Rabbi Avahu home? Oh, slight. Sorry. Okay. Why does he walk Rabbi Avahu home? Because the honor of
the kesar. Rabbi Avahu was close to the.
Rabbi Avahu was, and this we have. There's lots of evidence for and lots of references to. Was clearly wealthy, was clearly acculturated, and was, and where did Rabbi Avahu live?
Caesarea,
which was the seat of power. And he was in with the with the authorities, with Roman Byzantine authorities. the assumption also is that he was therefore also had contact with Christian authorities. The bishop of Caesarea was also the most powerful bishop for miles around. Mm-hmm. But what happened? Ahu yoma, alavei Rabbi Avahu leRabbi Chiya bar Abba ad ushpizeh. This time he walked him home. Oh, I'll walk you home tonight. Yeah, this one's on me. V'afilo hafilo itutev date mine. Even so, he doesn't buy it. Why doesn't he buy it? So one possibility is because he says that's easy for you to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure. Sitting on your millions, it's easy for you to say, "Well, I'm just a popular novelist." You know, but you're a serious poet. Like, okay, great. But what else? What else? What else might be going on here? What did we just all of a sudden learn? What's the relationship between the two of them?
Class difference.
There's a class difference. There's a huge class difference. Rabbi Avahu is an extraordinarily powerful person. And then you sort of wonder.
Chelav also know that Rabbi Avahu is better than him because he has more yichus.
Well, that's I don't know if it's yichus. Rabbi definitely have yichus.
I guess now whatever is better.
Well, it's protexia, right? How would he have gotten the protexia without? Mm-hmm. He has protexia. He's well placed. Mm-hmm. Right. So you wonder. Well, is Rabbi Avahu? Maybe why is Rabbi Yavahu getting the bigger crowns? Is it because the Agadah versus Halakha? That's one theory, which is very valuable to us in understanding between Halakha and Agadah.
Mm-hmm.
But you wonder if Rabbi Yavahu wasn't just the bigger name. And why was he the bigger name? Well, because he was this extraordinarily prominent person. I think he was also the Abbas in Kesaria, as I seem to recall. From the exhibit in the museum in Kesaria. So then the question is, okay, but like, does that mean that his shiur is really better? Is that what's really bothering him? Is the unfairness of this class distinction?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say. It's very left very open. But what we know is that this is not a satisfying answer to at least one person involved. But the other possibility is that he doesn't accept this notion. As you said, shouldn't everyone learn halakha? He doesn't accept this notion. He thinks everyone needs to learn halakha. He thinks that the halakha, that this is a shortcoming of halakha, that he doesn't accept this elitist notion. And he feels that his failure to communicate halakha to the masses is his failure. And it's not, doesn't show anything about that's just the way things are. that's good sales for a book of poetry. But rather he says, no, I should be, that if you, optimally we would be filling, we would be packing, Carnegie Hall with Shiurei Halakha.
Mm-hmm.
And not just with the fun stuff. So this sort of, once again, gives you a similar notion of this conflict and tension between halakha and agadah. And this notion, they're the two fundamental categories. Once again, there's a lot more going on in the story, and it's not clear that's necessarily the only possibility. But in terms of models and discussions of halakha and agadah, I think those two stories together give you a picture of that.
Mm.
Next week, we'll just finish up the two sort of weird sources from Chazal, then we'll move on to the Gaonim and the Rambam and the like.